Okay, thank you very much for the invitation to visit here. And during the talk, if you have questions, please just feel free to jump in. I don't have to go get through all the slides. So what I thought I'd talk about was first tell you a bit about sort of that the theoretical models that are needed to interpret gravitation waves, how we construct them, and especially how we construct them when we don't have vacuum black holes in general relativity. And I will focus mainly on the in-spiral physics. Of course, the merger and beyond is the most interesting regime, but we can also learn a lot just from looking at the in-spiral. And the main application will be in the context of neutron stars, but I'll also mention some broader uses of what I'll tell you about. So just to make sure everyone is on the same page, neutron stars are really interesting because they're the densest stable material objects in the universe that we know of. And the theory of them was already developed in 1939. And thousands have been observed to date, but we still don't know what is the nature and the fundamental interactions governing the matter at these extreme conditions. And so what do I mean by extreme conditions is basically you take all the matter of the Earth, crush it down to the size of a ping pong ball. So this is really the densest possible stable object you can form, because if you then crush the Earth down to the size of a large grape, you already form a black hole. So,
Chicago,
the grape is bigger than the ping pong ball. Oh, yeah, but you're supposed to imagine a ping pong ball and the grape as well. Okay, and so in terms of the broader importance of neutron stars is if we think about the phases of QCD, and here what I'm showing is on the y-axis temperature, on the x-axis sort of baryon density, and so neutron stars are really near the densest possible ground state of matter. At merger, temperatures might get a little bit higher, but it's a completely different regime than is probed, for example, by the LHC or heavy ion collisions, because at those collisions, you always are in the kinetic energy dominated regime. But in neutron stars, it's really the interactions between the constituents that dominate the physics. And then, of course, nuclear experiments on Earth, you can never reach the same densities as a neutron stars. So this is kind of, in terms of a bigger picture, where neutron stars are really important. So what we know about neutron stars, or at least the current picture, is that they are already in the outer parts very exotic material. So if you think the density of iron is about 10 grams per centimeter cubed, but on the outside of a neutron star, it's already 10 to the 6 gram per centimeter cubed, roughly. So, above, there's also a bit lower density stuff, but yeah, let's ignore that for now. So it's already the outer parts are very neutron-rich nuclei that don't exist on Earth because they would immediately decay. And as you go deeper inside, it becomes more and more favorable to have inverse beta decay, so to form neutrons, essentially. And eventually, the densities get so high that free neutrons will drip out from the nuclei. So this is what I show here as the yellow region in the outer core. It's basically a superfluid of mainly neutrons, and then there are also some superconducting protons. So it's a lot of interesting physics, but the most mysterious part of the neutron star is when you get really above twice nuclear density. This is what I call the deep core. And so there, you might imagine the energies are so high that new particles like hyperons will form, or you might transition to quark matter. So this is really the most uncertain part of a neutron star, because it's really far extrapolations from known physics. And also, theoretically, it's very difficult because it's a multi-body problem. We don't know the composition, and there are strong interactions. So this has been sort of a long-standing problem at the frontier of research. So now I will talk about what gravitational waves can tell us about neutron stars. But first, let me talk about how do we learn any information from gravitational waves for binary systems. And the way we do it is we compare the data with theoretical models, where for the theoretical models, we know how things depend on the source properties. And then for the best matched model, we say whatever parameters that model had, this is what we think the source was. And for this to be successful, of course, the models have to be highly accurate, so they have to match the phase to better than 1 radian out of however long the inspiral is. And they also have to include all the relevant physics and cover the entire parameter space.
So why it's only 1 radian? I mean, like, let's say
that's just
a very precise method. Is 1 radian enough?
No. It really depends. Yeah, this is, I just say as a sort of an example, but yeah, it's it also depends where that radian accumulates, if it's at low frequency, high frequency. So this is just not to be taken as serious numbers, just to get an idea. You have to really match very well these phase oscillations.
But it takes seriously. Waveforms that you're showing there, or are these?
Yes, these are effective one-body waveforms. So the blue is aligned spin black holes. With equal masses, the black one is aligned spin black holes with mass ratio 10. Just a 2-2 mode.
Yeah, what's special about that one? If I look at the minima seems to be monatomic. The maxima is point-to-point,
peak-to-peak,
yeah. Oscillating. So why does it show that asymmetry?
Because it's an asymmetric mass ratio. And
I would expect it to see it on both sides. Why do I see it in the maximum?
Oh, you mean because it on the lower part it doesn't... Yeah, okay, that I don't know. Okay. Yeah. And also, actually, I said it wrong. It's not just the 2-2 mode, but the 2-2 mode is the only one that's calibrated. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a good observation. I don't know. Yeah, and the orange one is when the spins are misaligned. So you see the precessional modulations. Of course, here, the most striking feature is always the amplitude, but in reality, in the measurements, it's the phase that is really the key importance. This is just for illustrative purposes. Okay, so to build these models is actually very difficult because we have to solve for the dynamical space-time describing the binary. And we have different methods for doing that in different regimes of the parameter space. So I'm just showing in an illustration on the y-axis the orbital separation, and on the x-axis the mass ratio. So as you go down in the plot, things get more relativist. And you see also in red is one example of a path to merger for one fixed mass ratio. So the binary evolves from top to bottom. And we have two exact solutions. One is Newtonian dynamics, which works for all mass ratios, but of course only at large separation. And we also have the test particle limit, which is even valid in the fully relativistic regime, but only if you have a test particle moving in a black hole background. And then based on these exact solutions, we can apply systematic approximation methods to push further away in this diagram. So for Newtonian dynamics, we have post-Newtonian theory that's always used for the solar system, and even for the binary pulsars, that's enough. And in the around the test particle limit, we have black hole perturbation theory, which is sometimes also known as gravitational self-force, and then has to be coupled with some multi-scale approximation methods to actually compute an entire inspiral. And of course, for equal masses at small separation, we don't have any approximation method. All there is numerical relativity simulations, but those are really computationally expensive, so it's not feasible to cover the entire parameter space with numerical simulations. But you already see for, so LIGO and Virgo, they don't observe very extreme mass ratios. So maybe the largest mass ratio they could see is maybe 1,000 or so. So for LIGO-Virgo observations, it's important that there is a gap between post-Newtonian results and numerical relativity. So we also have some methods for bridging that gap and actually computing an entire in spiral. And there are sort of two classes of models. One is phenomenological models that simply take a post-Newtonian inspired waveform and add additional coefficients and then calibrate those free parameters to numerical relativity. And the other method is what is called the effective one-body model that tries to combine all information in a slightly different way. So let me just, I don't want to go into all the details, but just to illustrate sort of what this model tries to do, it tries to take the two-body problem and map it onto an effective description where there's an effective particle with mass, the reduced mass of the system, moving in an effective space-time that is characterized by the total mass, and then also the what we call the symmetric mass ratio, denoted here by nu, which is reduced mass divided by total mass. And the feature of that parameter is that it always lies between 0 and 1/4. And the effective description is set up so that in the test particle limit, you'd recover in a test particle moving in the space-time characterized by the total mass. And the mapping between these descriptions is a mapping on the phase of the phase space dynamics. And it also involves what we call the energy map that relates the EOB Hamiltonian describing the two-body system to this effective description, or the Hamiltonian of that effective description. I just mentioned this because this kind of energy map comes up in many, many contexts. Also, when you consider scattering, it came up in the context of quantum electrodynamics when people wanted to solve for the bound states of positronium, and they only knew how to solve the bound states of hydrogen, and they could establish this kind of map, which had exactly the similar form. And of course, this is just for the conservative dynamics. Then there's also a way to include gravitational wave dissipation and also for computing the asymptotic gravitational waves. And the idea is to use this kind of in-spiral description up to when the motion gets to the light ring of the EOB dynamics, and then after that make a smooth transition to a final perturbed black hole. And in terms of how well these waveforms work, this is for the non-spinning case where they work quite well, and that's illustrated here. In blue is the waveform computed from numerical relativity, and then in dashed in the upper panel is if you just take the model without doing anything else. You just use the analytical knowledge but repackaged in this EOB picture. And then, of course, there's still some discrepancy here near the merger that can be eliminated by also taking into account information from numerical relativity. And the model can also be extended to the spinning cases, but we don't need that here because I want to focus mainly on neutron star binaries without going into complexities about spin.
May I ask, is this calibration that you're talking about, is that a well-defined procedure? Is that just really a curve fitting? Does one really understand how to make the corrections?
It's so in some sense it's arbitrary because all we know for sure is we have to match post-Newtonian, we have to match the test particle limit, we have to for the few cases or let's say for the cases where we have numerical waveforms we have to match the numerical waveforms, but how this is combined is I mean, the EUB framework gives you this kind of picture, and within that picture, there's still a lot of freedom how to combine things. So
it amounts to a curve fitting, really, or some parametrization of the waveform.
Yeah. So it's in some sense, yeah. I mean, there are attempts to do it more from a theoretically appealing way. So, for example, one tries to fit distortions to the effective space-time in a way that sort of moves around the horizon of this effective space-time. But there are two UB camps, let's say. One is at the AEI, and the other one is in France. And they each do different things to calibrate. And yeah, so in the that sense, it's yeah, just calibration.
But in the extreme mass ratio limit, there would be a much thinner prescription for it, right? So you could
yeah.
go there and then come back in some sense,
yeah.
some sort of flow.
Yeah, yeah, and I think at the AI they're currently working on this. Martin van der Meen is there, who is the Delphos expert. And, okay, other questions? Okay, so now we want to consider not just the waveform for black holes, but also ask the question, what changes if we don't have black holes? And of course, as I said before, the most interesting regime is the merger and beyond, but let's focus for this talk on the InSpiral. And so here in blue, you see a waveform that has been superimposed on the black hole waveform. And of course, this just shows in the last few cycles of an InSpiral. You see in the beginning, the two waveforms lie exactly on top of each other. And that's simply because when the objects are far apart, they act like point particles. So it doesn't matter what kind of object it is. And then, okay, you don't see anything striking. You see a boring-looking phase shift and maybe a tiny change to the amplitude. But for gravitational waves, these details of the phase shift are where a lot of the information comes from. So the phase shift could be due to a number of effects. There could be rotational deformations of the objects, the fact that they don't have an event horizon, or due to tidal effects. And for tidal effects, there's, of course, the tidal deformation of the object, but then there could also be tidal excitation of internal oscillation modes of the objects or internal resonances in the matter distribution, which are the most interesting, but those depend a bit on what kind of object you have. So you have to know something to be more specific.
So I like that you put echoes up there. But the coming is this outside the sensitive band of few MSN object. That's not necessarily true at least for some people that are echoes, because they could be much lower frequencies. But that's not what you're talking about. They could be the post-merger signal could also be at low frequencies, depending on the nature of that.
You mean higher harmonics of it? Or
no.
M equals one mode?
But I'm talking about exotic objects, right?
Yeah.
They could have much lower frequencies.
Oh, you mean they merge at much lower frequency? Okay. Yeah, okay.
No, so they merge at that frequency, but if they transfer some angular momentum of some non-spherical distribution of energy.
Yeah.
That could be yes.
But then you can write in a lower frequency.
Okay.
That happens to only mean echoes can be lower.
But that's what I meant. But I mean, that's also another possibility. I mean, you would have some object that's going around at lower frequencies. But I mean, actual echoes would have lower frequencies as well. So that's the echoes
okay.
Goes into like exotic compact objects. And the reason is that they have much lower frequency quasi-normable than regular black holes. So.
Yeah, I see. So then it might actually be a problem to distinguish if you have echoes coming in at lower frequency to distinguish these tidal effects, which you would also get for exotic objects,
yeah,
from the echo contamination, let's say. I guess, yeah, that's something to be aware of, maybe. Okay. So, yeah, just to say about the spin-induced deformations, when an object is spinning and it's not a black hole, then it will develop a spin-induced quadrupole moment, let's say, and that is proportional to the spin squared, and also given in terms of its mass. And there is a dimensionless parameter, or not dimensionless, but there is a parameter kappa that characterizes the whatever matter that object is made of, or the structure of the object. And that parameter is 1 for a black hole, and less than about 15 at most for neutron stars. But for exotic objects, it depends on the kind of object. And one thing to note is it scales quadratic in the dimensionless spin parameter, which if you're talking about neutron stars, that parameter is less than about 0.4. But although this contribution might be small for slowly rotating objects, the point is that in terms of a post-Newtonian counting, it enters already at second post-Newtonian order. So if you have a long in spiral, it could accumulate a small effect over a long time and still give a measurable signal. Okay, and here this plot is just supposed to illustrate for you where in frequency for advanced LIGO information about the source parameters comes from. And it's all normalized, so you can't get any meaning from the height of these curves. But basically what it shows is if you consider the trap mass parameter, which is the black, it all accumulates very early on. So by the time you get to about 100 hertz, you've already accumulated a lot of the information about the trap mass. Whereas for the tidal effects, they accumulate only at very high frequencies. But as I said, the spin-induced quadrupole is also at lower frequencies. This is just to show this visually what I just said. Okay, so now on to tidal effects. So let me tell you how we describe them in terms of modeling. Well, the first interesting thing to note is why did I not mention anything else besides tidal effects? Because in principle, in GR, for a strongly gravitating object, there could be non-tidal interactions that are non-perturbative and may not have a Newtonian limit. But it turns out that one can show analytically that this is not the case. It's really for non-spinning objects, tidal interactions are the way information about the internal matter distribution of the object first enters. And the way this is shown is by considering different scales involved in the problem. So the objects have a mass m and size r, and they're separated by a large distance, we assume, for the in-spiral d. So we can form different combinations of dimensionless parameters characterizing the internal gravity of the object, which we assume is non-perturbative. It's fully strongly gravitating. There's a tidal expansion parameter and a post-Newtonian parameter. And the way the description works is then we divide the spacetime into different regions. So this is just for the source region, not the asymptotic waves. But we have an interaction zone where we have a post-Newtonian expansion of orbital dynamics of point masses with small corrections due to finite size or internal structure, which then can again be resummed like in the effective one-body model I mentioned. But then close to the object, we don't want to use post-Newtonian because we want to assume these are fully strongly self-gravitating objects. So what we have to do is assume they're relativistic objects perturbed by a distant companion with a small tidal perturbation. And then we match these two descriptions, and then finally compute also the gravitational waves. So let me just tell you a little bit on the technical details of how we describe tidal effects. So we consider a body on a world line, with sigma being the parameter along the world line. And it has a tangent, which is a four velocity, and it has a mass, spin, and quadrupole moment. And then we say we can describe the dynamics by an effective action, which can be written as a point mass contribution, a tidal contribution, and then we also have to specify for higher than spin, we have to specify additional information about the internal dynamics of the multipole moments. And here, yeah, I should say, as is also written up there, this is specialized to the quadrupole. It can be also extended to higher multipoles similarly, and also assumes non-spinning objects initially. Okay, so let me now write down for you what the tidal interaction is, the Lagrangian. It's simply the coupling of the quadrupole moment to the quadrupolar part of the tidal field, which by which I mean it's the Weyl tensor due to the companion and then projected onto the four velocity so that you form an electric part of the curvature. And what you also see entering here is this factor Z, which is in some limits becomes like the redshift factor, but it's needed to make this action invariant under reparameterizations of the world line. And then for the internal Lagrangian, we can assume that the induced multipole moments, because now we want to say this world line, the multipole moments on it are induced by the tidal interactions, they behave approximately like harmonic oscillators. So we write down a kinetic term for the oscillators here, and then the elastic potential term. And you notice what here is a coupling constant that enters lambda, which I wrote as lambda, which we call the tidal deformability parameter. And I will discuss in a little while. For now, just accept that it's a parameter entering here. And then also what enters is the fundamental oscillation mode frequency. And then this is still incomplete because for the oscillation modes, they might not be in full spectrum, and this tensor Q might not encode all the response of the neutron star and so on, but this is assumed to be small.
Sorry, what did that assume to be small?
These extra contributions. That so we neglect extra stuff and just use this harmonic oscillator.
So Q is defined in EOR Doppler zone, is that right? How is Q defined?
Yeah.
And Q is actually associated with each mode, so there is a so Q is so there is another index, should be another index is Q associated with each mode.
Yeah, you can write. So you can write Q. Oh, you mean if I have like G modes, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. This is what I'm going to neglect here, but you're right. Yes, in principle, there should be a sum over radial nodes of this Q.
You're assuming and a single frequency.
Yes, this is just the F mode. I'm neglecting all other modes here. But this, of course, you can just add the same thing for the G modes and extend it to more realistic scenarios. Yes. Okay. So, of course, this is now in terms of the four-dimensional quantities, which contain many spurious degrees of freedom. So we do a 3 plus 1 decomposition to isolate the physical degrees of freedom. And after doing that, we end up with a tidal Lagrangian as written here. And I've now, instead of using the symmetric trace-free tensors, I use the spherical harmonic decomposition. To make it more clear that there's a periodic tidal force acting on the neutron star. And What's also interesting is once you write out what the internal Lagrangian from the oscillator part is, you get, okay, the normal oscillator looking part, but then you also get sort of a frame dragging interaction where there's a coupling between the orbital angular momentum and the angular momentum of the quadrupole. And so you can define a quantity that looks like a spin tensor associated with the quadrupole, which is essentially like quadrupole crossed with quadrupole dot. So that's kind of interesting that this comes out in this way. And then if you consider what are the scalings in this problem, so I should say up front, I'm also only considering mainly circular orbits. For eccentric orbit, this F-mode, Juan and collaborators recently did an analysis, so you can ask him about what happens there. But for circular orbits, the tidal forcing frequency is basically scales like Kepler's law. And the F-mode frequency is roughly scales like the scale of the neutron star. So in general, that frequency will be higher than the tidal forcing frequency, so the F-mode won't be tidally excited during the in-spiral. It's still a bit internal structure dependent, and yeah, also remember I'm considering non-spinning here. So an interesting limit is then to take what we call the adiabatic limit in this context, where we assume the tidal forcing frequency is small compared to the F-mode frequency. And then we can find equilibrium solutions to this, the equations of motion derived from the Lagrangian that are simply the quadrupole is proportional to the tidal field, and the proportionality constant is the tidal deformability parameter lambda.
So lambda is of order 1, or is it dimensionless?
No, it's of order radius to the fifth power. So it's not dimensionless. It's a response coefficient that characterizes the internal structure. Okay, and just to illustrate, for one example case of how this adiabatic limit compares to the more refined description, so here I write on the y-axis, I write basically a quantity characterizing the response of the neutron star. On the x-axis is gravitational wave frequency. And the horizontal line is, if you just assume it's a constant response, which is the adiabatic limit, but then the F-mode, even if it doesn't get tidally excited during an in-spiral, the resonance is so broad that there is still a significant enhancement of tidal effects compared to the adiabatic case. Okay, so just to wrap up the discussion of this tidal parameter lambda, so it's easiest to look at the adiabatic limit and just consider, let's say, the m equals zero mode. So then you just have the induced quadrupole is proportional to the tidal field with lambda. And as we already said, those quantities are all defined in the buffer zone of the object. And the way to compute what they actually are is you have to solve Einstein's equations in the interior and in the exterior of the object and match to compute the solution. And the point is, for at least non-spinning black hole, this parameter is zero. So it's a good way to distinguish any other object from a black hole. And you can also do similar things for higher multiples. So then what do you get? So if we then have a model for the neutron star interior, given here by the equation of state, so the pressure versus density, then you can ask, yeah, what global observables does that lead to? And of course, the first one is the radius of the neutron star, because that you get immediately from just computing equilibrium configurations. And then the next one, if you have linear perturbations to equilibrium, you get the tidal deformability. And one interesting thing to note about the mass radius curve is also, so each of these curves, so those are all different models for the equation of state, each of them terminates at a maximum mass. And we know from pulsar timing that about two solar mass neutron stars have been observed. end. But the interesting thing is, if you just have quantum physics, so no nuclear physics, just quantum physics, and you compute the maximum mass of just a neutron star from degeneracy pressure, from the quantum degeneracy pressure, then the maximum mass is 0.7 solar masses. So going from 0.7 to 2 solar masses, that is all nuclear physics, basically, to provide the extra pressures to resist the gravitational collapse. Okay, and yeah, you see from these plots that there's a direct correlation. Large radius stars have large lambda, and that can be in part explained by the fact that lambda scales like the radius to the fifth, and there's a dimensionless Love number in front. Okay, and yeah, this also.
I don't see that correlation. It's like, because they all have the same rating. The parameter is about that. That's what it's
okay. Okay, and yeah, the most dramatic changes you can see in these tidal parameters is when you have phase transitions. We don't know yet if those really exist or if it's just a crossover to quark matter, but it's definitely interesting to test. And of course, you could what's also quite interesting is the phase transition between densities you can get during the in-spiral and merger. But assuming also you have only the in-spiral, you could still probe phase transitions by probing the strange-looking mass tidal parameter curves. And then, of course, when you have phase transitions, that will also modify the mode spectrum. So the modes might be a more smoking gun signature to look for, if they can be measured, which, yeah, is not yet known. Okay, influence on the gravitation waves of all of this is that now, just first I'll tell you roughly, some energy goes into deforming the star, which is proportional to the tidal parameter. Then the multipole moments of the neutron star also are phase coherent with the orbital multipole moments, so there will be additional gravitational radiation. So then we can compute from energy balance approximately how the phase scales of the gravitation waves, and we find that at least for the adiabatic limit, it goes proportional to the tidal parameter, goes like a high power of the frequency, so this only becomes important late in the in-spiral when the frequency is quite high. And also the effect scales like 1/1 the total mass to the fifth power. So it's lower masses are more easily measurable. But when you have two neutron stars, actually what is showing up in the waveform as the most dominant imprint is some ugly combination of the two tidal parameters of the object and the masses. Okay, so these effects we also include in the effective one-body model, where here I'm just saying what is done for the adiabatic limit to include these effects. So the way it is usually done is we include them as additional deformations to the space-time. And oftentimes you see this parameter kappa 2t in some papers, which is simply the tidal correction to the energy and compared to the lambda tilde, which was the tidal correction to the phase, which comes from both the energy and the energy flux. And we can do now a similar thing for the
your effective space-time is curve plus deformation, so you're deforming curve.
Yes, for the spinning case, yeah.
Yeah, but this is for your thinking of dark body,
yeah, these deformations are determined from post-Newtonian.
Right, but at least you picture it coming together. Because if you have two different stars coming together,
yeah.
Let's say, imagine they're fought.
Yeah.
Very large radii, so the final speed is not going to be high. And so
yeah.
Why are you having care here? And what
I see.
Put it aside from her?
Yeah, yeah, okay. So you're saying I should take spinning neutron star space time or some space time?
Yeah, we don't have a good understanding
of
that. Right, so have you seen any kind of dependence? If there is a care, you short it, let's say. Is there any one or the other one that may be better?
So Kerr and Schwarzschild have been tried because, yeah, Schwarzschild is just the limit of Kerr. They use the same coordinates and so on.
So you have one more free parameter in Kerr, so you can probably think things better.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, the thing is, Kerr is not a good solution to the exterior metric of a rotating star. So
but neither is the Schwarzschild.
Yeah.
That's right. So then I wonder which one maybe better.
But if you have more free parameters, you can.
Yeah, so I should say, so spin effects for neutron stars are not really consistently included in this model. We have the spin-induced quadrupole effect, but we don't have spin tidal couplings and all kinds of other interesting effects. Yeah, so maybe it's easier if I just say I'm talking about non-spinning and use Schwarzschild instead of Kerr. But
well, then the space center does have a dead time momentum when the Murray happens.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that it's interesting also, to see if maybe with the, because people have come up with some approximate solutions for a neutron star in rotating space times to see if one could get a better map. Yeah, but that hasn't been done yet as far as I know.
So for the binary bundle, not spinning plates,
We use Kerr with spin zero. So it would just Schwarzschild, but yeah. Yeah.
So why is it different for the neutron circuit? Is it because you want to include these tidal effects? The tidal effects are more easily accommodated with adding this spin parameter to the effect of space time?
No. This is just a slide from some talk, and so let's say Kerr should be crossed out and Schwarzschild written there. Yeah. Because I'm considering anyway only non-spin. I should also say, so it's not written as metric plus perturbation plus perturbation. It's all then, this is what is done to get the analytical information, but then there's a resummation to write it as a log of something. Not so much for the tidal effects, but yeah, so it's not a simple linear addition. Let's say that. Okay, so for the F-mode effect, we do something similar, but now we don't want to include all these dynamical multipole moments in the model because then it becomes very not easy to control anymore. So instead, what we have is an approximate solution that approximates this response of the neutron star compared to the adiabatic response. And it looks, as you might expect, there's a piece that looks like a harmonic oscillator, but then there are additional terms. This one with the Fresnel integral is to describe near the resonance the dynamics, and then this piece is just to match the two into a single expression, to subtract the singularity. Okay, let me get to the application. Of course, there was,
sorry,
yes.
The resonance you're talking about, but you also said the F-mode frequency is pretty high.
Yeah.
You never really get that resonance.
Yes, here you see sort of this curve. If I didn't have that Fresnel term, it would just diverge very strongly already here, and that because then that's unphysical. I don't want that in my model.
Okay.
So even if I don't fully excite the resonance, I still have to model the approach to the resonance a bit more carefully. Okay. So now, I'm sure you've all heard of this. GW 170817 event, so much science could be done, and I'm only focusing on one subset of the science that was possible with this event. And you might have also heard they reported a measurement of the tidal deformability, now in dimensionless form, so they report for the big lambda, which is the small lambda that was the response coefficient divided by the mass to the fifth power. And usually the way it is plotted is lambda of the less massive object versus lambda of the more massive object. And then here are several equation of state models that with the same colors I showed you previously, which you might not remember. But let me show it in a slightly different way. So here is the same result, but shown as for the parameter lambda tilde. So here the y-axis has no meaning. You should just consider the x-axis is the measurement of this lambda tilde parameter. And all these colored curves are kind of indicate what is the systematic uncertainty in these measurements due to our incomplete knowledge of the waveforms. So you should see, take the two vertical curves with the same color are supposed to indicate the 90% confidence interval with one model. And if you compare, say, the yellow and the blue curves, that is the effect of having a spin prior, meaning you specialize two small spins. So, and notably, yellow is when there is a high spin prior, so not making strong assumptions on the spin. And you notice that zero lambda tilde is not excluded in that case. But since in that when you are less restrictive about spins, then it turns out the spins measurements, inferred spins, are quite small. So you might then go and say, what if I assume they were slowly spinning? And then you get the blue curve. Then comparing blue and green means changing the black hole baseline model. So that also has an effect, especially in the higher end. Let's see, then orange and green are supposed to be the effect of including spin precession and the spin-induced quadrupole. And then red and blue are changing the tidal model.
Sorry, what do you mean by blue, black hole baseline model?
You use either EUB or you use Phenom. So that also has an impact. And then green and green dotted, which has most of the effect down here, which is not so big, but it's a different parameter estimation method.
So these are upper limits, or what are they?
No, they are supposed to be 90% confidence intervals of,
so
of the.
The right are upper limit, the left is lower limit?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And then, of course, one should keep in mind this is these errors are estimated with our current knowledge. So this is what we can say at the moment. And also there are some detector calibration uncertainties that also give systematic errors, which I don't consider. But what you notice is, so the width of this window is larger than the systematic errors on the measurements. So systematics are definitely important, but they're not dominant.
So
I would say.
I think you said this, and I thought it was interesting.
Yes.
But on the left boundary.
Yes.
How are you? So there is a strong assumption in there that you think that there are two neutral stars coming together. So how do you rule out a dark hole with a neutral star?
You can only rule it out.
You
can only rule it out in the case when you assume they were slowly rotating. If you don't make an assumption. No, you don't have to assume that. Just if you assume both are slowly rotating, then you get all these colored curves that exclude zero.
Why do you? So how can you exclude zero?
It's not exclude. It's, let's say, disfavored. It's outside the 90%.
Right, but I'm trying to understand that you didn't see a validation. Right, you need observer modulation. So you can say modulation, the lambda was no larger than something, otherwise you would have seen a clear modulation. So now the lack of modulation, how how does that tell me that they couldn't be black holes?
Of
lower masses.
You
say one black hole plus one neutron star.
Or even two black holes. It's
still
maybe
not
two. It's just purely gravitational waves.
Yeah.
So this one, there could even be two black holes.
Well, for this one, for the yellow one, yes. That you cannot rule out.
But I'm surprised that you can have any of the other ones sitting anywhere beyond zero, even that the baseline is that it's so non-relation.
Is there some prior going that you're like assuming you have like a realistic equation or state and it's not a box?
No, the prior is in lambda is for each object can have 0 to 5,000, any value. It's not restricted. The only prior that now goes in is on the spins. So the yellow one assumes spins are less than 0.89, which is not very restrictive. It's just because the waveform models are restricted. And then all these colored ones assume spins are less than 0.05.
Is the prior uniform for those values of the zero at zero?
Which prior is?
You said that you have a prior, just that the low number goes from zero to something.
Yeah, it's flat. But it's flat in these individual lambdas.
So one of them could be zero. I guess I'm not sure why this is coming. So one of them could be zero and the other one not zero.
I'm saying that the DNC the merger.
Yeah.
You don't see the post merger.
Yeah.
You don't see any modulation of the waveform.
But I guess that they do see some modulation, and that's where the lower limit comes from.
No, you put a buffer bump.
Hmm?
You put an upper bump.
Yeah, and this plot is really with the unrestricted prior on the spin.
Okay, so then that includes zero. Nice.
Yes.
That's what
so in that case, you cannot.
But then what? What's the difference between this plot and the previous one?
That you're excluding the zero?
Yes, so what I show in what's in this plot, let me see.
What corresponds to the shaded blue in the second plot? That's really the question,
right? Is it the same?
Yeah.
This is supposed to be the same plot.
This is like the average of the two lambdas, I guess. Lambda.
Yeah, lambda tilde is the average, so it doesn't give you the information how
it's
things.
It's kind of like the tilted lines, if you imagine. It's kind of 45 degree.
I mean, most people like to say is that according to the second plot, these contours should also have some part that excludes zero.
But yeah, this is a different.
Yeah, maybe I put the wrong plot. Sorry. If you go into this paper, there should be two plots, maybe. I'm not sure they even show the plot.
That's okay, picture.
Yeah.
But it's not very significant, like you said 90%, so it's not very you start even a cancer detection, I guess.
I'm just saying what comes out of the analysis. Okay, and then if you make the assumption you're not on this yellow high spin prior result, you can then make an additional assumption that both have the same equation of state, and just consider statistical errors. And then in the equation of state paper from the LIGO collaboration, was an inference of the equation of state for the neutron stars. But of course, since the neutron star masses were not so high, the really high density regions that are in this cyan shaded line did not get broke by the event. So the results that are for the blue the blue is the 90% confidence intervals again. So up here, that did not get probed. It came from other constraints, like you have to make a two solar mass neutron star. Okay, so the tidal deformability also has broader uses. I mean, obviously for nuclear physics, it has many implications, which still remain to, you know, really work out the map between what is contained in the tidal parameter and how do you then go to nuclear physics quantities. Then for astrophysics, the neutron star radius is very interesting because we have the NICER observations, the Neutron Star Internal Composition Explorer. They should announce results at the AAAS meeting in January. So that will be interesting. And then for experimental nuclear physics, people are very interested in the neutron skin thickness of lead 208, which is measured by like the PREX experiment at Jefferson Lab. And then, okay, you can also apply it to exotic objects. You can, again, do a similar computation, compute the perturbed interior and exterior and match and extract this tidal quantity. Also for axion clouds around black holes, it will be non-zero. Or for dark matter halos. And one sort of unexpected implication is you can also test models for the cosmological constant as a vacuum energy of a quantum field theory, which is kind of nice. So this was done in this paper.
How do you test that?
Pardon?
How do you test that?
So it's basically saying if the cosmological constant comes from the vacuum energy, then if you have a phase transition that changes the vacuum energy, there's a jump.
Oh, inside the neutron.
Yeah, so they consider the phase transition that is in this plot here is kind of this line. I don't know if you can see it, but it's a color flavor locked phase of QCD.
So it's another constraint on the equation of state of the interior.
Yes, in some sense, but they have it in terms of the bigger picture of the cosmological constant model. Okay, let me just see how many minutes. Okay, I'm out of time, okay. Good. Then I will just jump to the conclusions. So in the next few years, we expect observations at improved sensitivity, especially also the high frequency sensitivity will improve. So we hope to do population studies, maybe measure subdominant effects. Probably not so likely, but who knows? We have to look for them. Then also maybe measure oscillation modes and do asteroseismology, which is, again, very interesting. And then maybe, if we're lucky, observe the merger and post-merger or tidal disruption. And then, of course, with third-generation detectors, all of these will become very more likely, let's say. And so we expect to learn a lot in the coming years with more events, but also it requires significant further advances, both in the modeling and also in the data analysis to accomplish this. So thank you very much.
Questions for Doug?
I was curious what the status of these dynamical effects that Weinberg was pointing out some years ago.
The PG instability. Let me first summarize what this was. So they argued there's a nonlinear coupling between P and G modes, which are different types of modes in neutron stars. It can be are coupled to the F mode. And once the F mode gets excited, I mean, not the mode gets excited, but once there's a bit of tidal interactions, this instability will be triggered. So the mode coupling goes unstable. The mode interactions go unstable. They suck energy from the system. And eventually, due to nonlinear effects, that instability will saturate at some point and continually draw energy from the system. So that would give a significant effect in the phase. But it's depending on what the parameters are for the coupling and saturation amplitude and so on. And so initially there was a concern that it would even spoil detection because it could be so strong. And clearly that didn't happen, because if we assume this was a binary neutron star, it was still detected, at least. So they can now put limits on these unknown quantities in the model.
But could it be that you end up obtaining the wrong parameters for the stars?
So I didn't read the paper. So there were two papers. One was by Duncan Brown and collaborators on this, and one by Weinberg et al. Yeah, but I didn't follow up. So I don't think anyone did a systematic study of the impact. Yeah.
My question is just a little out of this topic. Do you have some any comment or thought, like the equation of state key effects on this study? Like,
what do you mean, the equation of state effects?
Like, does equation of states can change some inspiratory form or something like that?
You mean the post-Martor waveform?
Yeah, the inspiratory phase.
The inspiratory phase?
Yes.
Yes. So, effect can come in a number of ways from the equation of state. This is what I was trying to illustrate in the dephasing plot I showed in the beginning, this one here. Not the horizon, but the rotational deformation would give information on the equation of state and the tidal effects and also the tidal excitation of modes. And so for the rotational deformation, there is a characteristic parameter that characterizes the induced quadrupole moment due to spin. And similarly here, for tidal effects, the characteristic parameter is the tidal deformability.
That also depends on the spin parameter. Like, there's a threshold, what kind of the spin number we should have, like weekly rotating neutron star may not be.
Yeah.
All of them, do you have any specific pinpoints to which point we should look at?
We should look at for what?
Like, I'm thinking of here some like highly spinning rotating neutron star.
Yeah.
Maybe can give some kind of different than the US.
Yeah.
But what about the like low spin case?
Yeah, the low spinning case could still have tidal effects. And okay, so low spinning, these rotational deformations will be small, but the tidal effects will still be there.
Okay.
Or are you thinking of an isolated pulsar?
No, I just think that I'm just curious about how big spin should be that we can actually see rotational deformation.
So that depends, of course, also on the equation of state and the mass ratio. But probably you need spins of at least 0.1 in this dimensionless spin parameter.
So in the future, do we expect louder like binary neutron star perturbance, and we want to go beyond just putting balance on the tidal deformability to actually measure it, and just have to tell us what the equation of state is. Do you think our theoretical understanding of these effects are good enough that we just do the pipeline and can get enough? Like, what kind of sort of theoretical errors can we expect on lambda tilde or something like that from our waveform models?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So models are definitely improving. So let's go to this plot where I had some of the theoretical errors. Or maybe that was the too confusing plot. But basically, so for the black hole baseline, I'm just using this because this shows different sources of the error. So the black hole baseline, so that we can expect to improve as you know, more calibrations are done, more numerical simulations become available. Also that models start to use the gravitational self-force information, which is currently only the test particle limit is used, but self-force could be included. So that we can expect to improve. Also, spin precession and spin-induced quadrupole, yeah, those, it's just a matter of really implementing it correctly in the models or using all available post-Newtonian information. And then for the tidal model, I think many building blocks are available, but also on spin tidal couplings and so on, but that still needs significantly more work. Also, from the numerical relativity simulations, I've heard for maybe 4 years already some effort to compare different codes and compare the error bars, but yeah, so far. Oh, I see. Yeah. Because that would also be quite important to know. Do we want to calibrate analytical models to the existing neutron star waveforms, or is it better not because the errors are too large? So, yeah.
So for this plot, should I take away that, you know, till all these issues you just mentioned are fully addressed, there's going to be sort of ballpark, you know, 100 or something theoretical error in the tilde, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to say, yeah, if we have that kind of signal-to-noise ratio again with the current models, yeah, we can expect a similar error.
Well, I mean, even if you have like a high SNR, you just don't know which of these theoretical effects kind of like is the error coming from that, like around. It's like the difference between these different curves.
Yeah. I mean, there's also then the question, because you're not usually not so interested in lambda tilde itself, how does this error translate into quantities you're interested in, like the equation of state? And so for this event, in the paper where they computed the equation of state, so they tried to see what's the error between two of these models, like the orange one and the green one, I think. And they found it changes the radius by about 5%. This is the number I can quote, but for equation of state error, this was not quantified, how it translates.
So can you go back to that picture on the central density, just to get a feeling for how much improvement of the data will be needed to start excluding equations of state?
Did you mean this plot here?
Yes, this one. Did you have another one?
So I had this one.
No, I want to plot for the equations of state for the neutron stars.
But this also includes some things there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have it in your back of your head, and you cannot translate. But you had a plot of M over R, just under the machine.
Yeah. This one. Yeah. So the ones that are excluded are these more extreme models that were, I think, also sort of not so favored by nuclear physics. Let's see orange and purple. Let me go back to this plot. Orange and purple are excluded, I don't know how much you want to say excluded based on this event outside the 90% region.
I just want to get a feeling for how much more accuracy improvement of the data would one need.
Yeah.
Really cut into the nuclear matter
calculations. Yeah. But it also, I guess, depends what masses we observe. So, yeah.
So the same event.
Yeah.
When LIGO achieves the sensitivity, how would it shrink curves?
let's see, so I think design sensitivity improves by a factor of 2, is that right?
Maybe a 2 and a 3, right? It was 90 megaparsecs. Yeah, okay, let's say part of 2.
Probably a bit more improvement at higher frequencies, which is about your idle.
Yeah. So I don't have the plot how this would look.
Do any of these equations say any of those curves have core matter or phase transition inside? Do you know offhand?
Let's see. So this one is MS1B. It's just nuclear matter. With the high symmetry energy, I think. H4 has hyperons. Then let's see. I don't have all the curves because they're, because the masses of these objects were also only around 1.4-ish solar masses. So maybe they didn't have these really high density cores. But we don't know.
So this parameter transmission and the date for this event, did they include this next speeding order pattern effect? It's only this speeding effect?
So these contours, these colored curves here, are the 90% contours with different models. And so the outermost one is just using only post-Newtonian information, both for black hole baseline and for the tidal effects, including tidal effects up to next to leading order, and only adiabatic tidal effects. And then these three clustered other ones are effective warm body with the NR-calibrated tidal model, and then phenom model with aligned spins and phenom model with precessing spins and spin-induced quadrupole. So those three clustered ones have a full black hole baseline, whereas and all three have tidal effects from numerical relativity calibrated model, and this has only post-Newtonian information. That's why I showed these other curves that have more of these ones where you can really see each difference of each effect.
Okay. Well.